so that's startling. So what I thought we should do is try to come up with some kind of summary of what have we learned for the whole time we've been here, and what do we think are the important things that we have learned, and what are the important questions that we still have that we don't understand. So I tried to write down an agenda that covers all the things that I think have been important that we've been talking about for the whole time we've been here. Right? And then my plan was we can say as much or as little about any of these topics as we want to. And I've asked Ryan to be kind of an official secretary. So if you say something that's deep and meaningful, then you have to look at Ryan and make sure he writes it down.
Okay.
And then the plan is that, you know, we publish at the end, we come up with like a 2 or 3 page manifesto of what have we learned and what do we want to do in the future. Yeah?
Paul, maybe you put the mic, and maybe that's just, and we can really put the sentences in. But we don't have to put it online, so, you know, just record it so that we
This is maybe something you go on. I don't think we need to be recording for posterity.
That's fine. I didn't mean that we put it online. Just for the bookkeeping purposes.
Yeah, I guess
so. Well, we can have a double entry bookkeeping.
Okay.
The second official secretary. The second official secretary.
I will do that.
Well, anyway, if we just put it on the wiki, then people can work on jointly, right?
Well, okay, that's a good idea. So,
remember their own comments.
So if we try to come up with a first version to put on the wiki this afternoon,
yeah,
and then other people can add their things, right? So shall I just spend 2 minutes going rapidly through all those things to make sure you know what I mean by those things, and then maybe in the you can think about if there's something which is not covered by any of those points that was important, or okay, and then we can go slowly through. So hopefully that's, does that make sense already, what I've written down? What does ME mean? Because ME comes up in a lot of data analysis and it seems that we don't really know what it means. Number 2, we're using coalescent theories and null model in a lot of cases, but is it valid to make conclusions by comparing things with coalescent theory when coalescent theory misses out a lot of things that are important? So do we need better null models than that? And then we were talking, and somebody in one talk said it was death to the neutral theory. And then somebody that I think was Michael, was it you that said this? That it's not death to the neutral theory, but it's death to linked sites.
Independent sites. Death to independent sites.
Death to independent sites, yes. So, okay, so that quote is attributable to Michael.
But it was 3 weeks ago,
I don't accept long-term responsibility for
it. Well, we won't write it on the wiki, but I thought it was you.
I can always take the politician's point of view, right? This was cited out of context. And but it's
well, I thought it was good. I will subscribe to that sentence. Okay. So
I think Carlos Bustamante is going to be here next week.
Oh, okay.
And so he'll take aim at this one. Okay, he's been one of the leaders of, right, extending this random Poisson field model of independent sites measured selection.
Okay, so interaction selection with geography and migration. So I mean, both the geography and selection are important. And is there something we get by having both of them in a model that we don't get by having only one thing? So this is something I've been churning over. Like, if we were to have some complicated model with both geography and selection, would it do something which is more important or different from a model with only one at once? Right? And then we're interested in human population genetics, and we've had quite a lot of talks about humans and quite a lot of talks about other species. So I'd like to kind of talk about why, or, you know, in what ways are humans different from other species? What data would we like if we could have somebody produce lots of data for us to analyze of any kind? And then duplication of genes and losses is about genome evolution. How does the content of a genome change? And then we've had quite a lot of things about gene regulation. I mean, is it true that higher organisms evolve by changing their gene regulation, but keeping their genes, and bacteria evolve by changing the genes? That kind of, how important do we think gene regulation is in terms of evolution of new species, for example? So, is there anything important that doesn't come under any of those topics that we should add to the agenda before we start?
I think Billy's talk really raised another interesting, important issue, and that is just the meaning of adaptation, selection and adaptation, the meaning of adaptation.
So,
I've had a couple of people who are not here now, but attended this symposium earlier in the session, say they listened to your talk, and I think it's very important.
I'm just thinking, I'm going to put that there. I think that fits in, meaning of adaptation.
Right, but it somehow fits also the point number two, that what should be...
Well, I could make it 2.5.
That's enough closure.
Are we happy with that? This was the sanitized version for the blackboard, but on my sheet, what I actually wrote down was that means a lot of crap. So, and what I mean is that, it's called effective population size, and if we're going to call it that, then it should be something that's to do with population size. So, for example, if we were trying to use an ME to represent the fact that the population has expanded exponentially, or a population has fluctuated in size randomly, or whatever, or been through a bottleneck, then I would be happy to call it ME, because it is really talking about population. But ME covers a multitude of other things which have got nothing to do with population size. In particular, it's got something to do with selection, and it might have something to do with mating strategies, like, whether the top male gets all the matings or whatever. And none of those is really to do with population size. So that's one reason I don't like it. And then the other reason I don't like it is because it comes up with numbers that seem to have nothing much. But what does 10,000 effective population size mean? It's not a very informative number, right? So I would like to think of other ways of summarizing the amount. But we're trying to use ME to summarize the amount of variability in gene sequences between members of a population. And there must be better ways of doing it that don't call it a population size when it's measuring something else.
So my impression was that it's essentially a parameter used to, it produces a parameter to fit within some model that corresponded to something that initially the effective population, but now if you have something more complicated that happens, then you're fitting one parameter which has to describe all these different things. Just a question then. So if we had an effective population which depended on time, because this seems to be a big problem, right? If you have a population that fluctuates a lot, you look at the genome at the end of the day, and then you try to fit an NE that describes this data you're seeing, then clearly if this single effective population has to describe the whole evolution, it's going to be hard for it to correspond to something.
Yes. So, counting one parameter to describe all genes.
But what one tries to do when lumping something into this NE is get some measure for the stochasticity of a single locus experiences, whether it's by hitchhiking from some linked selective marker somewhere else, or whether it is a big distribution in offspring numbers, a very wide distribution of offspring numbers, whatever. It really doesn't have to do much with population size, but with the stochasticity, you go from the genetic drift, random genetic drift, some measure for that. It's an inverse diffusion constant.
Right. And it's just a way of saving some of the observations in an arbitrary complicated situation. But I don't think that that's the right way of saving the observations, because you don't necessarily learn that much from it.
Well, it was in the first model when this was introduced, it corresponded to something reasonable, and it did correspond to something like an effective population. It's just that if you try to apply this to any model, then the meaning of this parameter gets lost. try to force any observation you make into the neutral coalescing model, and for that, to make that fit, you have to.
Right. I guess it's sort of everybody agrees in this room that if the theory or the underlying process is more complicated than the neutral theory, then this measure is no longer what the neutral theory posits it to be. I guess the interesting question is whether that quantity, and we could, for the purpose of this discussion, instead of calling it any, we could take an operational point of view and say, well, what we do is we can measure theta, that's an observable. So any is not directly an observable, but we can also measure mu. So we could call it theta divided by mu, or theta hat maybe. And the question would be whether theta hat remains sort of an important observable to retain, even when the neutral theory has gone. Does it epitomize something that we should remember this number? Does it mean something? And
we have two ways of measuring theta. So theta is an observable, but we have at least two ways of measuring it. So how do you want us to define theta now?
Well, there we could take your favorite one, and
you're the one who said it.
Right, so, I mean, in that sense, any is just a scaling factor.
As some people call it theta, just the scale mutation rate. Because I guess part of the problem is that maybe in its origination, there was some understanding that the breeding population size may not be the entire population. And so you can think of this idealized number that fits the data that may not correspond to the census population size. And in Crowe and Kimura have actually a very nice chapter on different ways of measuring any of the inbreeding affected population size, the sex dependent population size, and all a bunch of different ways in which the population size is somewhat is less or the effective. But I guess the point is that at this point, with genomic sequence, for example, finding that this scale parameter NE could be orders of magnitude different in different parts of the genome, it just takes you so far away from any notion of population size that towards something like scaling factor. And so maybe we really need an entirely different notion of what that term means and move away from calling it something related to population size, which it really, I mean, I think we're all saying, it just has such a distant relationship to it at this point that it's a bit more misleading than informative.
Maybe taking on that, we could, for example, if we have a simple model where there's strong selection, but sites are reasonably, are still independent, then this, what we call an E would be just 1 over the selection strength, namely the travel time of a polymorphism, which was an E, is now shortened to 1 over S. So what we call an E would be essentially the inverse of a selection coefficient. And of course, then that could be very much varied in different parts of the genome, and there would really be no reason to call it a population size anymore. But it would still retain a meaning, although that meaning might become local and is no longer global.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to recover it? To just make some expansion, essentially add parameters in a somewhat systematic way to recover a mean? I mean, it's nice to have a variable that describes something like an affected population.
I think it's hard to get away from it in the sense that, fundamental population genetics theory says you can estimate the mutation rate from polymorphism data, but it's scaled to something. So it's a product of.
I mean, what I like is this in the sense that you can observe things like the fraction of polymorphic sites. And that's unobservable, so you can't, somebody's put the microphone on. So you can't argue that, right? Because you just count things. And then the rest of it is interpretation, right? And so it seems to me we should say, this is the direct observable, and we should try and make the theory explain the observable, rather than going on. The problem with NE, I think, is that you go a step away from the data to something which is not easily interpretable, right? And then the theory, then if you think NE is an important quantity, your theory tends to aim at predicting this, rather than predicting the direct observable. But I've got a question mark. I mean, so is it a scale mutation rate? I mean, it is if you believe the neutral. I mean, if theta is 2 main mu or whatever, then it is. But if theta is something else, which depends on selection and the amount of recombination and the amount of lineage and all that, then you can't really call it a scale mutation rate either, can you?
Yeah, you know, the problem is that you know, no matter what your theory is, mutations enter the population every generation, and the number that enter is the mutation rate times something to do with the number of genomes that are contributing to the future ancestry of the population. Now, those may be subject to selection and may turn out to be vastly smaller number than the actual census, but still fundamentally, I think, I don't know if it's easy to get away from a theory of population genetics that doesn't, you know, you have to have this entry of mutations that has to be multiplied by something related to a population size.
But on the other hand, the sort of keeping population size fixed it seems to be a very questionable method to begin with, and you know, an alternative could be describing it as describing population dynamics really more as you know, birth and death process, right, where N itself becomes fluctuating, and so it's actually very, 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 very curious because you know, dealing with the branching process in many ways is simpler than dealing with the Fisher-Wright model, and then you kind of wonder, so many of the difficulties of Fisher-Wright model are caused by this insistence on keeping population size fixed from generation to generation, right, rigidly, as opposed to fixed on average as, you know, we would do in statistical mechanics. And then you sort of wonder how much of a pain is self-inflicted. And on the other hand, then, as we've heard many times in the last couple months, the whole thing gets re-examined sort of in view of demographics, and you know, this assumption gets questioned anyway, and then one has to re-examine all the parameter inference in view of all possible bottlenecks and et cetera, et cetera. So you kind of wonder. But so from that point of view, sticking to something that is really observable is very appealing, right? And somehow what's really observable is that you know, right now there is that theta that can be inferred, and right now the population size is something we know. So then one can, at least in principle, contemplate you know, some theory which is just conditioned on the current observation and integrates over all possible past histories, right? Which you can do with the branching process, too. Right? You can do things backwards, conditioned on the, now there being N observables. But on the other hand, I think if you do it this way, you know, certain things about branching, about coalescence, for example, will change. And so if we say that predictions of a coalescent are, you know, golden, and anything that gives us something, you know, instead of finite time, finite expected time to a common ancestor gives us, you know, logarithmically divergent time, is a no, no, no. Then of course we're back to where we started, but it's not at all clear to me that those inferences are written stone, so that they really should not be re-examined. And
so is there a good way of considering a population that's kind of approximately fixed in size? I mean, I think what you're objecting to is having an exactly constant thing, right?
Yeah.
So now suppose, is there a good model, an obvious way of having a population that's, you know, allowed to fluctuate with some average that's constrained?
But that's sort of, that's easy, right? That would be like going from canonical to macro-canonical.
But you need a way of...
But it would still, of course, the fact that NE may, if selection is strong, have not much to do with sort of any senses. I think that will be common. So this would not depend on whether you make the constraint soft or hard on N.
No, I think this is
sort of orthogonal.
Well, I guess what I'm mumbling is so the simplest way is to take your branching process, and so if you want to be neutral,
yes, but that doesn't have an average. I mean, that goes
precisely
very large.
So if you do that forward, you'll arrive at the conclusion that with probability one, everything goes extinct.
Yeah.
But we don't care about that because we know that we haven't gone extinct, right? So you run things back. So now there are ways of avoiding this sort of silly problem just by computing conditional probabilities.
I mean, I would sooner have a model where you have something like a carrying capacity, which, you know, when your population is higher than that, there's a higher death rate, and when it's lower than that, there's a lower death rate, and so on. And then you're going to fluctuate within some well-defined range, right?
Sure. That probably won't be very simple.
No, I know.
But still,
yeah, you can certainly...
When you start thinking about linkage and all the effects that has, then the actual dynamics of those kind of genes affected by that linkage and hitchhiking almost have no relation. Or, I mean, that's the question in my mind that I really have no intuition about, whether there still is any kind of relationship between the two, in the sense that, I see a locus that has relative to the rest of the genome, much reduced variation, and you say to yourself, well, the efficacy of selection, operating on a mutation at that locus may be much weaker than at another locus that has a lot more variation, maybe because it's in a higher recombination. Mm-hmm. How far off are you in that kind of simple kind of intuition that you can take something like 1 over this thing we call this scale of population size, and that actually is a reasonable proxy for the efficacy of selection? When the actual population size may be orders of magnitude different, so the selection dynamic is actually operating on a much larger actual population size, the net result of all this linkage and hitchhiking is that there's only a small amount of variation at the locus, and it seems as if that locus is evolving in a small population size, when it's not actually. All mutation still has to go through the big population. And so I just don't know how far off, Otto's theory, the weak selection theory is, especially when there's a big difference between the real population size and
I guess it's
probably effective population size.
Maybe it's still okay to even call it the effective population size, taking the notion that it is something which is proportional to the population size if we keep every other constant of the theory fixed, because then if you have double as many individuals, we expect double as many mutations entering the population. But we need to depart from the notion that it's an independent parameter of the theory. Instead, it will be a derived parameter that itself depends on linkage, on the strength of selection, and so on. It's still proportional to the population size, but it may be modified by a big factor, and as such also differ between regions of the genome and so on.
because it's a derived variable and not a primary variable, as in the neutral theory.
Is it obvious that the theta is still proportional to the population size? I mean, the number of mutations entering the population must be proportional to the population size, but is it obvious that the resulting variability, you know, as measured by the theta or something, is still...
I don't think if you keep everything else the same.
Well, sort of what Daniel Fisher was telling us is that it's proportional to the log of that.
It's not all obvious that it's linear then. Yeah. Because the establishment probability depends on all sorts of other things.
Right. If your linkage dominated, then it's log. And, yeah, then
well, you know, in his thing, is it? Well, yeah. Sorry, I guess it's asexual, so it's linkage dominated. You may say, well, it's not obvious that it's linear. Even with recombination, except in sort of very high recombination.
Right, but it's still like at the boundary layer, the mutations entering into the population, it has a clear linear proportion. And so maybe we just tried what Michael said, that N of E is a function of the other parameters, and see if that is helpful. Like, see.
I've lost track. There seems to be a disagreement of whether the ME is proportional to N or not, and I'm worrying that it's not, which is another good reason to...
Well, it depends on what ME is.
So, Paul,
if you write this ME as a function of sigma and recombination rate or something like that, then you can basically put that proportion at some regimes of those parameters. So it's
I have to keep the other parameters fixed, and then I just double the population size, and does the NE double? That's the question.
Well, I guess the agreement was that it doesn't work like that if the link is high.
And if it doesn't, then it's even sillier than I thought it was, right?
Then it depends really also on your sample size, like how small fractions of the population are you measuring it? Are you measuring polymorphism before they sort of enter the selection regime and so on? So it's clearly, so the question whether it's proportional to N or not is even then frequency dependent in some sense. So it gets, but it's still true that it's some function of N and S,
hopefully
the combination rate and so on.
But wait a second, I mean the number of mutations entering the population is definitely linear in N.
Well, it's a different point. Entering, the question is entering, what do you mean by entering?
Entering, I mean, you know, appearing in individuals. Really,
most of them are going to die immediately.
But this is then...
They're going to die of drift, right? And
right. But...
so I mean, it's not... So theta is not the number that enters. Theta is the number that survives.
I have seen theta most of the times in neutral context, and then it's a different story anyway. And then I'm also not sure whether this log n anymore holds, does it? In a neutral context.
Well, no, the log n is sort of strongly linked and strongly selected.
But the log n the log n was something of substitution dynamics. It's not, we're not yet talking about that. This is, how I always understand is, this is then part of the theory that comes after this entering. So first you need the mutations, and then you talk about what is the dynamics that a selected mutation needs to take to go through, for example. This is a whole other story. But for saying how much variation in principle, how much potential for variation there is in the beginning.
No question.
There is still, I think.
No question.
Okay.
No question. Right? No question. But to the extent that theta on the blackboard is defined as the observable.
Okay.
You know, the big question is how do you relate that to this sort of bare mutation rate that you're talking about? And, you know, it's not exactly true. But I guess my best understanding of, what we heard said about NE, NE is just a proxy for drift. right? So, one is ultimately free to define, to call, the strength of, so the diffusivity due
to
drift.
We could call it big D for drift and diffuse.
Precisely. And then the question is, what does it do? So, if you say that it's Kimura, well, okay, so then it's 1 over n. But if you say it's fluctuating selection, then it's going to be something else again, right? And if you want to call fluctuating selection effective population size, well, that's fine. It's not worth arguing about as long as we understand that what is referred to as NE is drift, right? And I think it's somebody, I don't quite remember, there was one talk where NE became a local quantity along, so was varying along the genome.
Yes.
And at that stage, people like me say, well, listen, let's just call it something else.
Yes.
If we just called it D, then we wouldn't be so scandalized by varying along the genome. But on the other hand, it's all semantics.
Yeah, I agree. I guess on the long term, we should have a more enigmatic name. It comes from that historical source of diffusion, and so in those cases that so when you say here D for drift, then you mean also it including draft. If you just mean anything makes small or real frequency changes in a sort of random diffusive way. Yeah. And
But you might want to distinguish it from, I don't know, draft, like hitchhiking events that change the real frequencies by sort of order one amount.
Right. It could still be only referred to those which are sort of the short, short time diffusive kernels. But as such,
it's a reasonable effective parameter.
Constant or one over mass.
You can sort of remember that's what it is. It's just diffusivity, right? We don't have any problem with that, right?
Okay, so
are we done?
Just diffusion.
Should we move on? I remember hearing a talk about 5 or 6 or 7 years ago by Warren Ewens, exactly on this subject. Just give the talk. I'm going to talk about NE and what it means, what I think it means. And the gist of his talk was, he just started out and says, Niels Runfeld of population genetics, and none of you know what it is. I'm going to tell you. And he basically argued, you can't forget that it's just this little theoretical construct that in this idealized theory, gives you a number that when you set it to a certain value, it gives results that look something like what you actually are observing. And then he went on to talk about the pitfalls.
But did he have a different view on it than we just expressed?
This was.
Is this sort of effective diffusivity that is being matched by Kimura model in his view, or like you were saying something else?
I think his view was that you interpreted it as meaning anything at your own risk. That it's sort of just a number in this theory that when you set it.
But the number in the theory, we would say,
It's part of the worries that we have just circulated are not even covered by this wider notion of just diffusivity, because that's exactly the reason that you mentioned. If you are in a regime of strong linkage where large allele frequency changes occur as a in a coherent way to these hitchhiking events, then we may still measure theta, but it would also not be in a simple relationship with this generalized D,
because the diffusion approximation mm-hmm. breaks down. Mm-hmm. And because we have like coherent changes of a little frequency that are neither covered by draft nor by drift theories. So it will, one stage later, also this generalized D is a question of, and in that sense, it's a meaningful parameter in the sense that we can ask, does it tell us something? And it will tell us something if it's a small scale of frequency changes, and then it's a meaningful observable that can be inferred from the data. And if there is no such process that is dominating, then it would also be irrelevant. But it's, in that sense, it is a useful, very useful parameter, and remains so even in the interacting theory.
Well, do we have two definitions now? One is the supply of mutations, and the other is diffusivity. And those don't seem to be the same thing.
Yeah, but the supply of mutation doesn't need another parameter, because the supply of mutations is obviously the mutation rate times the real population size. So therefore, we don't need to call it anything, because it's, right?
It's not effective. It's just
whenever we infer, though, we're always getting some NE instead of the real N. So if we knew the real N.
Yeah, but what we're getting is some sort of a time scale to the most recent common ancestor, basically the time we had opportunities to putting in mutations.
Well, I think we're getting that estimated in a neutral model, though. I mean, the problem is
exactly. You
try and roll in all these selective effects into something we call NE. And what really is happening is your model doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And so when we use NE, it's what we're doing is scaling the population size to match our observations. The predictions of a neutral model is our observations. But when we scale it with S in some selective model, then none of the other predictions of the neutral model should be expected to match our data, even if this one that we've scaled to does. So I don't know, I mean, at that point, I don't know if NE is really useful at all to talk about.
Well, precisely. So, you know, the question.
I mean, if it's neutral, if we're talking about population structure, it absolutely does the job. But when you keep rolling more and more into it, and then you're fitting like multiple things with one parameter.
So should we take this as a conclusion to point one?
Well, but I mean, that's in some sense it's not surprising. I mean, if you take it, it is an observable. In some sense, and
is it an observable?
Well, if
NE.
Well,
no, it's not.
We've done NE.
We're on two and two and a half right now. So, so when I wrote down that, I was thinking about the talks you had at the beginning, where there's a lot of useful mathematics that can be done by the neutral coalescent theory, and then you try and fit it to data and conclude things. And so what I was worrying about is, if we're fitting the neutral coalescent model to the data, can we actually conclude anything? That's really what was worrying me.
I think that was just your comment, right? That on the last issue, to the extent that the world is not neutral, then all these nice mathematical identities linking that one observable to the others are invalid. It may still be a valid observable, but just as for relativistic motion, we shouldn't take Newton's equations, but generalize them appropriate, then the mathematical identities they obey will be changed. And hence, just hoping to infer something from some neutral coalescent is no longer warranted.
So did someone talk here about coalescence and selection? I didn't hear any of these talks. So
I think there was only one talk. Last week,
Karsten. But that was some seminar class. I didn't know that talk.
Griffin, hint a little bit.
No, I think it was
last Tuesday.
Yeah.
So he talked about coalescing for rare alleles.
Yes, this is all.
Yeah, but before then we had Bob Griffiths and we had Simon Myers and we had.
They didn't talk about selection.
Yeah, they didn't talk about selection.
Yeah, but what they did is they.
You know, Bob and Dick Hudson were here for 2 weeks and they spoke quite a few times. And they didn't really even, except for one little toy example,
Bob drew
a coalescent for some beta hemoglobin data
which is quite old. There was really almost no attempt even to fit, you know, the data to a coalescent. I mean, it's really been striking to me over the course of the meeting, and we have met people like Graham and Simon and others who are very capable coalescent theorists and were trained that way, who essentially don't use it at all. And I've really been struck on the huge space between what coalescent can actually deliver and what the real world is like.
Can I ask something? So I don't know this coalescent theory that well, but it always struck me that it's basically with the trick that you can just exchange the you can have one tree and then you randomly sprinkle the mutations on top of that. And that's the trick that then makes things work. And that doesn't hold anymore when you have selection. So you have the one trick that makes things possible, but we observe that you should not actually consider only mutual case. So that's like, is there any way out of that problem?
So Karsten actually had rather nice result, but the idea is again to get away from Fisher-Wright and do the branching process, and the way it is justified sort of without too much offense for the rest of the coalescents, is by saying that the only looking at rare alleles, right? So to the extent that you're only looking at the small subset of the population, you can relieve yourself of a large end constraint. And then you can redo that part of the story with the branching process, so using the statistics that you derive the branching process under selection, and the time scales change. And so, for example, you expected time to common ancestor for the rare allele is very different. And it's actually a non-trivial result, right, because it depends on the absolute value of selection, so somewhat unintuitive. And then I didn't quite understand it, but Karsten said that that sort of reproduces the old result of Murakami or
Moriyama.
Moriyama, excuse me, some Japanese name. I guess done actually with Fisher-Wright model.
Right.
So it wasn't ultimately exactly clear what was new coming out of Karsten's thing, but except for it was done in the context of the coalescent, and sort of left you hoping that one can do more if coalescent is indeed as powerful as we all think or hope.
No, that's right. And I don't know, now it's already maybe 7 or 8 years since that Neuheiser Chrome paper first showed that you can model.
Oh, which one is that?
Neuheiser
Chrome. Okay.
They're two mathematicians. Mm-hmm. So they published a very influential paper showing how you can model selection on a coalescent when selection's not too strong.
Mm-hmm.
And
so let's see. So it wasn't just the rare alleles that they were talking about.
No, it wasn't just
rare alleles. So that's interesting.
But unfortunately,
then we should do a journal club on that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
We have a volunteer.
We'll see. Because I just told that I don't know the qualities. It would be too much of a
lesson. You have to model the coalescent, and then you have to work your way back up. So you have to go down and then back up somehow. And you can take into account.
So it was Neuheiser and someone else.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can find someone else. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, let's see how difficult it is, because then we could talk about it.
Yeah.
But there's been very little progress beyond that, initial papers. Right?
It's sort of clear that it will get
much more difficult because it will have to contain all these crossover scales about which we have been talking about.
Well, that's the other issue. Selection is one. But and Bob Griffith did talk about this and Dick a little bit about how difficult it is to deal with recombination.
So
I mean, when you have data with recombination,
it actually serves as a separate point in our list, because it was sort of the main topic of weeks and weeks of this workshop, that we need a model that deals with this.
So, Joe Felsenstein has worked on that, and he has a program that people use to try to estimate simultaneously, the recombination rate and the scale mutation parameter.
Wait, so as opposed to Lee Stevens, which seems to be an industry standard?
Yeah. I haven't used his. People use his to try to estimate like the minimum number of recombination events. Something like that.
I thought it was used to estimate the recombination rate along the chromosome, and that's basically what people use to get hotspots and whatnot.
It does, but I don't think it's a true kind of attempt to build a coalescent fit.
That is certainly true. That is certainly true. So it's.
It isn't for sure.
That's right.
Some people criticize it.
That's right.
Really being a population genetic model.
That's right.
More of a statistical model.
That's right.
So Felsenstein has a true coalescent population, and it still only will give you anything reasonable for small data sets, and recombination rate not being so high. And I think that's been discouraging. We could, I tried to get Felsenstein to come and. We're back. We're trying to get him for the last week, and I was going to talk to you about what he did volunteer was maybe to talk to us remotely. We can set up.
Okay, why not? We can try.
And so maybe we can try. Maybe we can ask him.
By tech.
Talk about sort of problems and limitations of coalescing. He's also played around a little bit with. Trying to think about how to model selection on the coalescing as well.
The one thing that I asked Bob Griffiths when he was here, what he thought about the attempts to put selection in the coalescent, like if they were effective. And he gave me a one-word answer, which was no. So I thought that was just kind of interesting.
Wait, the answer was, the question was whether he tried?
Or? No, whether he thought any of these things was very effective.
Oh.
And he just said no.
So when we do the wiki, would you write down some of those references? Because there are things we haven't talked about and you should probably know about, right? We haven't, let's do 2.5, right? Do 2.5?
2.5.
What are you going to say something about 2.5?
Well, this is something that I've thought about. Fitness is very well defined when we look from generation to generation. We can very easily define what that is. So we know if something is adaptive or not because it raises the fitness. But when you look on timescales, on evolutionary timescales, and you say that something, maybe it raises my fitness this generation, but 100 generations down the line, it no longer has exactly that same effect. Then on those timescales, what is our idea of fitness? And what is our idea of fitness? Is fitness just non-extinction? Is it making sure you didn't die out?
And I think you're raising the question. I think to describe adaptation, you need both time scale. And you also even need a length scale, depending on what scale of objects you're looking at, something's going to be, in equilibrium in one case, but if you look at a smaller scale, it looks like it's adaptive. So you also need a spatial scale, I think.
Isn't it easy to define when we say I want to define adaptation on the population level? So I'm not interested in whether this individual is fitter the next generation or whether it does something that is fitter, but I'm interested in whether the whole population gets adapted to a new environment, for example. And this then is a number that we can, or that we can cast into a number, like Villa did, into a fitness flux or something. But there was also, when I had to write, defined on the population level. I mean, you talk about frequencies going up and down, and this is always the whole population, right? So fixations and...
Well, which of those changes are adaptive rather than just neutral?
There, you can say every fixation to a allele that overall sets the whole population fitness up is an adaptive step. But then you're not interested in these little polymorphic steps, but you're talking about the substitutional time scale.
But that was a good point with these time scales, so that clearly you can think about the long scale evolution. Like I think what Stefan is now talking about, that there's this macroscopic change, that you have substitution events. And for the substitution events, one way to define it is to just use the notion of equilibrium and static fitness landscape, which I think makes a nice null model. This is why I wanted to have this as a 0.2.5. And then if you look the process and you try to identify if you deviate from that normal, that somehow tells you that there's a coherence change going, and these changes add up. And this short time scale thing, that would be at the polymorphism level. Like,
yeah,
the frequency is changing and adapting, but it doesn't necessarily add up in if you observe the process with longer time scale.
So when you set fitness for one generation is not necessarily equal to the long-term fitness, for what reason might that be true? I mean, what was your reason?
The long-term fitness is conditioned on survival. Now, we had these mutated phenotypes of Paul last week, or was it a week, 2 weeks ago? I don't know. They seem to do better. They sort of explored more rapidly the pool of beneficial mutations. But at the same time, they screwed up everything else and died out after 92 generations or something like that.
Yeah, but that's not a problem with the definition of fitness. That's just what happens in that case.
This is just one example of that fitness may be time dependent. And for these mutated strains, it had a short term advantage. And then due to the accumulation of deleterious mutation, it had its thickness declined after a while. So that is just, but it can be, of course, for many other reasons that fitness becomes fluctuating on short time scales, in which case the average over longer intervals does not need to be identical to the momentary value.
And it's important that the short-term and the long-term effects are fundamentally decoupled. So you always go in the direction of the short-term fitness. Long-term fitness you can't feel ever in terms of the dynamics.
Well, one of the...
You can't condition a survival
fits
in the long-term.
If you have competing populations, you can, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But then that's a different level of selection.
Right.
So at the level of the population.
But fitness... So, well, life is a branching process, and branching processes are unstable. They either go to zero or they go to infinity. And one of the things that we always do without sort of mentioning it is that we add this sort of density-dependent limit on our population size. That's what we do when we fix the population size. And so that, to me, that changes what fitness means in the long term. For instance, let's say our population adapts instead of just one individual. Fine, I can see how that spreads. But now that my whole population has that adaptation, and I've run again into this density-dependent cap. And so, has my population adapted? Is it more fit?
That's the point of the different scales, right? I mean, if you look at the, you know, a single mutation, and even if you take a large fixed population size, right, you look at the subgroup, and then you can talk about adaptation at this subgroup, right? Even though the population scale, and you can't read off adaptation. And it's a bit of the same thing about these populations that, you know, you've got more and more mutation, the higher and higher mutation rate. And then you can say, well, yeah, are you adapting on a short time scale? Are they, well, it looks like they are. Are you adapting on a long time scale? Well, then it doesn't look like they are anymore. So the definition really has to depend on the scale you're looking at.
Well, fitness is a relative thing, for one thing. I mean, it doesn't depend on whether we constrain the population size or not. Because, I mean, the difference between, or the relative rate of reproduction of two strains is not dependent on whether there's an overall capping of the population size.
That's definitely true. But there's also an absolute scale here, which is, over time, life has to have a fitness of one.
Well,
it's not going to make it.
No, I agree.
So it's both relative, like when different individuals are fighting, and there's an absolute scale that we sort of forget about a lot of the time, I think.
Maybe I didn't understand this last comment.
Sorry. No, I mean, like, actually, it brings to mind Richard Lewontin has a beautiful piece on the meaning of adaptation or some such thing, where he goes through numerous counter examples or counterintuitive examples of, just an example that you were talking about, an imposition of density dependent. He said an example, if you imagine you have some population of birds that are, say, cliff dwellers or something like that, there's a fixed number of sites on the cliff where they can breed, and that limits the actual population size, physical constraint. And but a mutation and the on average produce a clutch of 2 eggs per female, and a mutation comes along where a female can lay 3 eggs, something like that. It's very clear that that allele will be advantageous because she has a greater chance of leaving descendants, and so that mutation will sweep through the population, and it will then have a mean of 3. But the number of breeding sites are the same, and ultimately there's exactly the same number of individuals. So in what sense have they become more adaptive? So there's that sense of it. But I guess, you know, I was thinking about like this meaning of adaptation, maybe slash interpretation of selection, because there's so much interest in trying to read out some of the kind of parameters of selection from population genetic data. I thought that was, you know, one of the interesting things that Gilly was pointing out, that there are some potential problems and fallacies with interpreting population genetic data and the standard tests for selection because of these issues of how you think kind of the selection is operating or contributes to adaptation.
We have talked about these different timescales of fitness and then how they influence the dynamics if fitness is fluctuating. But I guess there's one more point that we should sort of remember it, and that this was also the main theme of Willis' talk, that even if the fitness is perfectly sort of well defined and not strongly fluctuating, then not every change that increases the fitness should be counted as an adaptation, because things have to be referred to a phenotype. And at the very moment when they are referred to a phenotype, then one should ask whether this change is really just offsetting a previous deleterious change, or is doing something new in the sense of a directional motion towards something, towards a new phenotype. And so that remains true even if the fitness is a perfectly constant function. So there's another level of problems too.
Right, so I think this is a nice way to put it, the static fitness landscape as a null model. So that, is there coherent movement to some direction or not? Whether it's just whether the phenotype stays the same or not.
And
this applies not only to regulatory sequences, but I can still do a lot of protein evolution. I just don't think we have a good, you know, model for understanding protein evolution. And I say I like to cite the example of triosphosphate isomerase, the enzyme, the kinetics of which has been very heavily studied.
And under sort of standard substrate concentrations, it's basically diffusion limited enzyme. So the basic idea is, you know, that it, the longest time step in conversion of substrate to product is just the amount of time it takes for the substrate to migrate in, fuse into the active site, and then it gets turned over, you know, almost instantly. And but the TPI is an ancient, you know, metabolic enzyme, and it has this beautiful beta barrel structure, and that's conserved. It's pretty clear that that diffusion efficiency probably was achieved at least a billion years ago. But you can see it, E. coli and human, and everything has this, you know, this very highly conserved structure and active site. So the extent, but there's plenty of amino acid substitution across the protein. But how much that involves running in place in some sense, as opposed to real adaptation?
Yeah, running in, okay, that's a good phrase, isn't it? Running in place.
You got that one before?
I guess. Because I've been looking for a word to describe what you guys are doing. I was calling it turnover, right? The idea that there's a continual turnover of alleles driven by changing selection. And you were calling it fluctuating selection. This is the same thing we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So we need a good name for it. Is it coffee time?
Whenever you'd like.
Or do we want to?
We want to cover all eight.
We need to probably rub some of them out.
Well, you know, first of all, this discussion can be continued because we have additional days this week, but even in the next 2 weeks, we can certainly set aside our time. And I think actually it's a wonderful idea to do this, especially if people would be willing to work on it jointly and eventually maybe you'd be willing to sort of take the lead as the lead author. Because it kind of would be nice at the end of the day to produce some kind of joint document that people who are not here in the room right now but who have participated, mm-hmm. they all have access to the document. We can actually produce something. And having done so, I would be very happy to publish it in a journal like Revolution or something like that. Despite this conference, because all these talks are online, people can look at them, and it would be fun to actually do. You sort of have to do it anyway, right? For the
well, not necessarily, but it's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be a very nice idea, right?
That's very nice.
So what would be so? Okay, I can see.
You think, but, you know,
we need to think about that.
We don't have to finish it now, but
okay.
Great discussion.
Well, let's take a break now, and then we'll do one or two more points, and probably not all of them, right?
That's great.
Session on this, because this is more biological, right? What we've been doing is kind of theoretical. And this would be kind of us thinking about biology a bit more. And I'm not in the last week, so I can make a request not to do that till the last week. Anyway, so, okay, so shall we think about Michael's quote? So he's
I guess that this was a striking, somehow for me, the most striking sort of common theme about in this workshop, how often this problem of linkage popped up and in how many contexts it's actually not solved.
So everybody agrees with that, and then we all hang out our heads in shame and move on to the next point.
Why is it unsolved? That's something I've never understood. Why has it remained unsolved?
Well, it's hard.
How is it hard, exactly?
Well, you know, interacting.
So can we just start like with this data that what is the observable here? How do you know that there's linkage? So do you need to do this clonal interference stuff? So what do you measure from the genome?
So how do you measure? Well, you measure recombination rate, I guess, for one thing. And then you have to estimate the time. So you've got to measure a recombination rate, and then you've got to measure the time it takes for mutation to spread, I guess.
Oh, but one observable is this of linkage disequilibrium patterns.
Right, and that you have already at neutral. Neutral theory.
That you already have a neutral theory, but they sort of can become more extended and sort of possibly non-trivial as you have sort of selection on different parts of the genome.
So you basically measure the correlations between polymorphs. That's like what is your, if you have real genomic data, what do you do when you measure linkage? So you take polymorphs and you look the correlation with them.
I'm not sure whether this observable thing is the first problem here. Isn't the first problem that we know that linkage confounds, for example, efficacy, I never know how this is pronounced actually.
Efficacy.
Efficacy of selection. We know this from theory, from simulations, from numerics, from analytics. We know that this is reduced. And now we measure something, and since there might be linkage, we're not any more sure whether it's the correct interpretation of what we measure. Isn't this the problem? I mean,
I think you give me a simpler question, which goes right back to the quote, and it's that I don't know. If you have a theory with no selection, but then linkage, can we just? I mean, is it boring? Is it all known whatever happens there? And is it just because when you introduce selection that it becomes all messed up and hard to solve? Or if you have a neutral theory with linkage, then is this all unified? I just don't know.
Well, I think the two-body problems, the neutral two-body problems, reasonably well understood.
Yeah, Carson has done some work to show that at least for statistical estimators of demographic history and things like that, you get the same, you get consistent estimators in a neutral linked model.
But some things remain very simple
in
a neutral linked model. Because it's essentially that the travel of one polymorphism to the population is not its own frequency dependent. It doesn't matter to what other sizes is linked. There's no force affecting.
Yeah, you just have sort of an additional
still
rate that
look at compound observables that may be difficult. But some things, let's say the single particle sector or something like that of the theory remains simple and equal to the independent.
Right.
But you also know things like the correlation of coalescent times between two.
Right.
2 points as a function of the distance.
And that definitely matters, in trying to actually test that model or interpret the data, because when sites are completely unlinked, then under the standard neutral model, essentially there's just a Poisson variance. And when there's a lot of linkage or no recombination, then there's a much larger component due to a variance in the actual stochastic depths of genealogical histories. And so that matters. So you come upon some locus or region that has an unusually large amount of polymorphism. Is that just because it has one of those unusual neutral deep genealogies or not? I'm trying to model that and knowing something about the recombination rate and how correlated the histories are.
right now. But Ryan is writing something even meaningful.
Well, Michael pointed out that some values, point values, like expected polymorphism, is unaffected by linkage, but the variance is not.
Yeah.
Right. That's
it wouldn't be, okay, what you were talking about was when there's selection and linkage.
No, even in with no selection at all.
So, I don't know whether I believe that. If you're looking at one side, then you can forget everything else.
But then
variance thing, like if you think about it, you want to make many trolls from this system, and they are not independent anymore.
Yeah.
The variance is not.
Okay, that's
yeah. So it decays different.
So variance in the neutral rays.
Yeah.
But for this problem, is it fair to say that this is sort of probably manageable by theory, since essentially it's just introducing a new length scale on which things are strongly correlated, and we could think of sort of an effective correlated with, and or is that how people work to
learn? Say, I agree with you, it is, but maybe there's also an issue though, depending on because I guess under completely neutral model where you don't have any selection operating, really you can look at the relationship between the scale mutation rate and mu, and or any mu and the scale recombination rate, and when that scale recombination rate gets large compared to the scale mutation rate, then things become quite independent. And so it's looking at those two. But when you have linkage caused by hitchhiking and selection, things like that, then I think the world becomes a lot more complicated.
Oh, yeah. Then
and
I was just
my question is whether or not when you see a lot of this kind of linkage, is it are we in an equilibrium world, or is that the causes of that linkage such that it's pulling us away from?
So the one thing that has been sort of continuously confusing is some people, when they say linkage, they mean like physical linkage along the chromosome.
Yeah.
They are so and so many kilobases apart, and they recombine every so and so often. And other people, when they say linkage, they mean there's sort of correlations between this locus and that locus.
Yeah,
which have nothing to do with sort of physical
recombination. Yeah, we should get away from that. I mean, that's right. I mean, generally, there's physical linkage.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it doesn't have to be physical linkage, because you can have linkage disequilibrium between things on different chromosomes. And actually, Daniel Fisher, I think we talked the other day, he said that it goes away after one or two generations, which is actually not true. It goes away at the rate of like 1 minus R, so it decreases by 50% of the classic example. You can actually set up the population with linkage disequilibrium at different chromosomes, and it'll only go away at 50% rate each generation.
So here's another sort of nomenclature question. So for which of the two meanings do we want the word linkage?
Yeah. I think I think we really mean in the sense of correlated histories.
Okay. I mean, correlation is a good word for correlation. And linkage is a good word for physical linkage on a chromosome, isn't it?
Well, maybe we should give it a different term.
That would be my natural interpretation too.
I would actually also
equilibrium of some sort.
I mean, I also tend to sort of, I always thought of linkage disequilibrium as a misnomer, because it had nothing to do with linkage in this narrow sense,
right.
And it has nothing to do with disequilibrium. It is just that it's just a strange word for a thing for which there is also a good word, namely correlation.
So how confounded is when I go to the internet and download a recombination map of some species along the chromosome? I can do that, right? There exist these maps. And people have, and then I once asked, how is this actually measured? And I was hoping that the answer is, well, you know, you go in the lab and then you see when you count the number of crossovers in some time. But no, it's counted by a linkage disequilibrium between polymorphisms, between single nucleotide polymorphisms. So if we define linkage in the how correlated are polymorphism sense, then we also have to redefine recombination, I guess, that it affects that. Or what is the length scale of this decay? So and how so how does this recombination map that one can download and this method of measuring this via linkage disequilibrium, how well is that related to the real physical linkage and the physical recombination? And does that even matter?
Well, so for humans, agreement is pretty good on the megabase scale.
Yeah.
So that was Molly has shown with the heterates and other people with sperm typing and so forth.
Okay, so there exist independent checks that the
recombination but below the megabase scale, it becomes increasingly blurry, and there are some hotspots they find in sperm typing that are not in LD and vice versa.
Okay.
And there are some papers in Gisafwa as well that Peter and Alfaro wrote, and I'm citing Molly, maybe a co-author, where they argue they don't match very well with, I can't remember which is. Applies much more recombination than the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gisafwa is a good example in the sense that it has a very, very good classical genetic map. People actually measure the recombination rate in crosses.
Yeah, so I think old-fashioned genetics experiments really did measure the frequency of the occurrence of the recombinant genotype, right?
Yeah, but you'd be surprised. I've been told this, and I don't know if it's true, but like even in great model of genetic organisms like the yeast, only a couple of the chromosomes have good classical genetic maps, where enough mutations are actually mapped one against another to be able to do it.
Well, but yeast is now pretty. They sort of mapped it on 100 base pair scale. There's not too many meiosis, but
yeah, well, they have some really clever ways now. They actually look the distribution of binding sites or some
markers of recombination. Yeah, there was one paper this summer where they
really
took apart 100 ASCII and and genotyped everything. It was like a 100 base pair SNP frequency.
Yeah.
I think this one part of the aspect of LD coincides with sort of what we get from linkage is like, which was another point which we which popped up very much in the first part of the workshop, and we also probably don't have a good answer to, namely that there can be another main reason to cause correlations, that is epistasis. Mm-hmm. So how much epistasis do we have in our genomes? How would we be able to measure it? And is it something that is a small perturbation effect that affects a minority of stuff? Or is it the rule? And I don't know.
Do we know how strongly correlated polymorphisms are which are not linked?
That would also be.
So, you know, we look at polymorphisms on different chromosomes and ask if there's any correlation between them.
Oh.
This is something that Guillaume Barrett keeps telling me we should do. He's not hearing.
Nobody has done that?
Well, I don't know. I'm asking you.
Well, I haven't.
But
people looked at that pretty carefully with alazine polymorphisms. Because they're easy to measure, a lot of loci, and their chromosomal locations were known. And there's, other than where there is inversions, and there's very, very little.
But also, that would be the wrong way of measuring, right? Because it would not be that everything is correlated to everything. It would be if that one site in one protein is correlated to something else in another protein, it is without the functional information which pair to look for. It's looking for a needle in a haystack.
Right, so this is the disease association stuff. This is the multiple testing problem squared. So
going through all the pairs, they always find stuff that are correlated, but you would do without any real correlation. So how to actually measure it in a real system? Yeah. Like how to find it if it's there?
And sort of what is going to happen in the real world is that in some subpopulation, some pair of these epistatically interacting things is going to rise in frequency. Maybe in other populations there is a pair. So you don't really see much of a correlation within the population, but if you lump them together and look across, then you see a big correlation, which then you might interpret your population structure again. So it's kind of all confounded.
Now, we had a talk on that, right? So with this, which was that talk? Right?
Yeah, Max's.
Yeah, there was something. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then there has been some real experiments done. So this is what Martin was talking about. So with experiments you can test this additivity, and you've got things.
Yeah, I think there's a big challenge, this question of epistasis. And actually in Ward Watt's story about PGI, I think we didn't talk about it, but there's some quite nice evidence for epistatically interacting amino acids. Mutations in different alleles. But in general,
I have people looked and just thought about it, so that if everything is very, very epistatic, then you kind of get stuck somewhere. You don't anymore have any free movement. So maybe there's like a limit that. So this is like almost the cost of sex stuff that you need to have some way of breaking. So maybe that's not a very nice discussion to have here, but like other theoretical limits, because you get stuck if you have very strong epistasis everywhere, and kind of stops the thing.
I mean, we don't live in that world.
Yeah. So either
we do or we don't.
We don't.
Wait, sorry, we don't live in what world?
Very epistatic.
When you say epistatic here, you mean just like change in sign of selection as opposed to change in an additivity, right? Yeah. Because you can have extensive epistasis defined as
softer way.
Right.
Okay, the sign epistasis would be the ultimate case that you then actually.
But sign epistasis you need for getting stuck.
Exactly. Yes, this is okay. Cool. So there's softer ways of deviating from the additivity.
Right.
So you mean how rugged the landscape is in which we
live? Kind of. Like people have thought about this a lot, but I just don't know what's the outcome, whether they can get a limit of.
But the distinction, like talking about sign epistasis or whatever kind of epistasis, really only makes sense if you compare two loci. If you have many loci, you know, all these individual effects can be pretty vanishingly small, and they just sum up to have some crazy effect.
So what is a sensible model of epistasis for many linked sites?
Well, trait, for example, that would be a simple quantitative trait, for example.
But you see, there are really two issues. One is, I guess, maybe the official word is physiological epistasis, as in, if you generate mutations yourself and study your favorite trait as a function of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 15 mutations, people study it with 2 mutations, right? So you're going to measure one thing and, you're probably going to find a lot of epistasis. On the other hand, it's an entirely different question of what is the statistical epistasis that you're going to look at, you're going to see in any given population that has been evolving for some time, and has conceivably converged to one particular adaptive minimum or maximum. And so you're probably not going to find much epistasis. So in that sense, we do not live in the world with a lot of epistasis, because in the world, a lot of epistasis we can't live.
You mean, because close to an adaptive maximum, individual most mutations have weak effects, and then the other ones are squared? Or like epsilon squared? Is that what you mean?
Or that you only maintain polymorphisms that do not interact. And furthermore, you have polymorphism at low frequencies, such that each individual polymorphism only sees some kind of consensus background.
Right, but do we want to, okay, so do we want, but
in a polymorphism
basis, we don't want to define only when there's polymorphism, right? So we can ask.
Well, that's physiological epistasis.
That's physiological epistasis, okay. Right? So from a point of view of systems biology, from a point of view of systems biology, right? If you just say, I'm going to screw this up and I'm going to ask, does the effect of this mutation depend on what else I might screw up? Well, you know, it probably depends on lots of things that we might screw up. And some will be buffering and others will be aggravating, right? But the question is, do you find sort of monkey wrenches like that in the natural population? You know, they're probably dead already, right? So I think the best evidence for epistasis that you're going to find in population, or better yet, populations, is outbreeding depression. And that you have, right? So there is all sorts of evidence that if you take worms from different ends of compost pile, and you try to mate them, their offspring are less fit. Okay. Right? So, right? But on the other hand, if you look in the population of, for the variation in that particular worm, one or the other end, you'll actually find very little variability, and what there is probably will not be terribly epistatic, right? But so this goes back to Richard's remark. That, so if you look at, of course, you can say that there's population structure in this, right?
Yeah.
So maybe so you'll see some linkage disequilibrium in worm A and worm B, right? At least when you just analyze two populations together, and you say, well, this is just demographics. Right. So you can explain it by demographics, but it doesn't mean that there isn't something else. So that was our little discussion with Nordberg.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, well, it can be explained by population structure. Well, it can.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that there isn't anything else. Right. Yeah. But the experiment that one needs is this outcrossing, right? You need to mate them and see what happens. So from that point of view, Paul Stokowski, right? With Saccharomyces, with Cervisia, right? So there are these three wild populations, and they're completely clonal, right? But you cross them, and they show outbreeding depression, mm-hmm. Right?
So then it means sort of on a physiological level,
there is quite.
Yeah. It's just that it gets lost in statistics, and it gets lost in statistics for two reasons. One is, even if it's there, it's hard to find because you have to go to high order and you have little statistical power and multiple hypothesis testing, all the usual nonsense. But it's not even obvious that that it should be there in the first place, because just the population dynamics will try to get rid of it. Right? It will try to converge it. If you have several possible solutions, right? It will, this is still right. So it will converge into...
It's very possible that you're in a very high dimensional landscape, so it's very possible if you have like many local solutions.
Well, precisely.
And globally it looks like a local minimum, but you can have a stasis just like essentially going around at the bottom of this valley, essentially, right?
Well, no, but just think of it differently. So think of, as a result of epistasis, you have these local minima or maxima, right? And in a given population, a given population will pick one of those maxima and live there happily ever after. And
depends how much we do.
So what you're saying is naturally occurring polymorphisms will not reveal the underlying epistatic structure.
Not necessarily.
You believe that there is a lot of that.
Not necessarily.
To the extent that there's small effects. I mean, for example, if you're at the maximum from
something,
and so the first order, all the first order polymorphism don't show anything. However, if you have, for example, something that makes a quantitative crater, changes it in on scales larger than the inverse curvature.
Right, and if you catch it, if you catch it before that thing goes away, you'll see.
Right.
Right. But it will, you know, after you generate one, it will try to, population dynamics will try to converge back into a maximum.
Well, unless you have some entropic effect, like when you have, then you always will go to the ridge of this sort of quasi-neutral thing, and you may have a chance. I mean.
Sure. I'm not saying that, but what I'm trying to say is that there are population, evolutionary and population dynamics is trying to hide that stuff from you. And statistics makes it difficult to find the little that there is. So if that's what you want to study, probably the best bet is to take two divergent two isolated strains and cross them, and then it jumps out at you.
You are saying that the polymorphism samples the local fitness landscape, and everything looks kind of additive when you are at a very local scale, and then you need to have this big jump, which is the two populations. To actually tease out the effect of the
That makes sense.
That makes sense, and it doesn't have to be so. And I mean, so from the I come from the perspective of solving constraint problems and so on. And one thing that people have realized is that they had these pictures of solving hard problems where you had many, many local minima.
Right.
And then people have figured out, I think, rather recently that this picture often was probably not correct, and you might have systems which are really hard, but which didn't have many local minima. And the problem is that you have it's really this high-dimensional thing, which is a hard picture that you have. You get your minima in so many directions, but then you have these.
So you have lots of ridges, you say?
Exactly. Yeah, you have lots of ridges, but statistically it looks like
Well, that's well taken. Sure.
Okay.
I'd like to understand epistasis on the point of view of protein structure, because intuitively, protein folding is a fairly global thing, and you would expect it to depend on interactions between amino acids in many parts of the sequence, right?
Well, so to the extent that, we believe all the bioinformatic evidence. For example, the stuff that Martin presented on two-component systems, right? To the extent that they see mutual information or whichever way they identify co-evolving residues and then map it back into the structure, and it looks like these things are so significantly close together. That's epistasis, right? Right. That's presumably linkage introduced by selection, right?
I mean, one of the epistasis exists all over the place. I mean, this physiological epistasis is obvious. I guess what Boris is saying is that this is sort of like a neutral theory of epistasis. There are lots of bad mutations in the neutral theory. They just don't matter. So there's lots of epistasis that goes on. It just doesn't matter for most of the evolution we see.
Wait, what do you say doesn't matter? I mean, it matters.
This is selection. Short scales.
It is selection. But, I think it will affect...
You can just call it additive selection.
Wait, why? I guess the question is how many, whether these things are sort of segregating at the same time or not, right? So to the extent that you are...
Yeah, but if they aren't, it's irrelevant.
Well, precisely.
Is it epistasis then? they interact, but it doesn't matter.
Well, right. I mean, so to the extent that the background is fixed,
yeah.
Right, then you just see, you know, differential fitness for, you know, this or that allele, and that's that, right?
But I mean, I think that was, you go back to Fisher, and his argument wasn't that there was no epistasis, it's that it just didn't really matter.
That's right.
But I think we should not, like, limit the definition of epistasis to where there are where it's visible by polymorphisms. Because that, I think that would, I mean, there's plenty of examples of fitness correlations. I mean, in any quantitative trait, even if the trait value is fixed, in a population, yeah, then it makes very much sense to say whether, for example, two consecutive mutations, one knows about the previous one with respect to changing that quantitative trait and the resulting fitness of that trait.
Well,
so that will go away if we limit our definition of epistasis.
Well, NE. We're sort of stuck with a legacy terminology here, and in fact, there was, I think, a Nature review just a month ago. Who was it? Basically discussing giving definitions of epistasis, and sort of just went through this whole smelly mess. And as far as I'm concerned, just made more of it.
let's for example, you take the easing model at zero temperature, right? All the spins are pointing up. If you occasionally do one down, you don't see interaction with any other spins because all the other spins are up. So you wouldn't say that for that reason there's no interactions in the easing model.
Listen, I'm with you. I think it's the battle we can win. But at least it sort of helps to realize that there are sort of several completely different notions of epistasis circulating out there, so different people actually use them differently. Right.
But so is it consensus in this room that we should really sort of call any fitness interaction epistasis, irrespective with whether it leads to actual correlation that's observable?
Well, no, frankly, I personally like sort of Fisher's original notion, so epistasis as sort of deviation from whatever linear regression,
yeah,
you know, deviation from additivity in in statistical analysis, right?
Right.
And the rest already has a name. It's called protein interaction, genetic interaction. What, right,
But those are two very different
things. Gene interaction, right? But these are two very different things.
Yeah.
And it's when you start calling them with the same name that
ruggedness of the fitness sensitivity.
I'm sorry?
Does the protein interaction cause ruggedness of the fitness sensitivity?
Well, I know fitness is another story. Now, going from protein interaction into fitness is another.
But that's what I'm saying is the point, isn't it? Because epistasis is a property of fitness landscapes. Either a rugged landscape or a smooth one, really.
Well, locally, I mean, the idea is that locally, when you define all the sort of, it's smooth when you get local enough. And it's only over longer distances that this ruggedness comes into play. So if I just regress everything onto the most local landscape possible,
this is
then I can regress away the epistasis. Is that all that matters?
I don't must be using two mutation cases.
I don't really mean what you mean by local.
Yeah, exactly. Is it really smooth in a local?
I think local
it's in the space of it's in the space of allele frequencies. So there's actually a continuous space.
Assuming no correlation.
Even with correlations, you can define your.
Wait, why do you want frequencies? I thought that you just wanted to define fitness on some crazy hypercube and the problem.
Mm-hmm. Are we doing that now?
Oh, no. Yes, but it's in discrete genotype space. which is tested in principle, right? Imagine in principle we have a way of making a mutant gene and sticking it in an organism and measuring its growth rate or whatever. I mean, in principle, that's testable.
Yeah, and people are, you know, trying to do
So Joachim Krug had this five locus epistasis, various amino acid deficiencies and other kinds of things. And that was like, that was rugged.
Were they deletions?
This is this vine line?
Those were deletions of all genes, right?
Delisa. I am Delisa.
Ah, right, okay.
I feel we're winding down. Are we at the end?
We had created a 3.5, and so we...
Oh, 3.5 moved to 2.
But this innocent epistasis sort of evolved into a sort of major point on its own. So epistasis was actually not on the initial list. It's just sort of popped up in the last.
Oh, you think you want me to call? This is
true. Well, I don't want to call it, but this is why we are still before 4. And
so point 9. What is the use of agendas?
Right. I think we've stuck pretty well to the first half of the agenda.
Yeah, exactly.
think positive. Yeah, no, it's great.
You seem to be off the ball.
Shall we finish then for today?
Okay. Yeah, so tomorrow we have 3 p.m.